Pretty Much Pop, a culture podcast powered by a 30-foot mechanical undersea robot arm that usually doesn't work. Today we're discussing the 1975 film Jaws and its legacy in light of the 50th anniversary of the film. This is Mark Linsenmeyer, always better in 3D.
This is Al Baker, every bit as English as Robert Shaw, but only about half as drunk.
I'm Sarah Lynn Bruck, the head, the tail, the whole damn thing.
This is Lawrence Ware coming to you from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. And in my life, I try to stay Jaws-itive. Jaws-itive. Jaws-itive.
Repeat it. We'll get it eventually. Jaws-itive. Well, someone had suggested this. Who suggested this when this was coming up?
It was probably me, because I just loved this film. And I like an excuse to talk about any kind of old film that we know is worth talking about rather than taking a risk on a new film that may not really be worth talking about.
Sure. And I feel like we are very slowly getting, you know, a history of pop culture film through The Exorcist and this. Like, what were big things before we were aware of them? I mean, I was old enough to be aware of the Star Wars thing, but not quite old enough to be aware of Jaws. And in fact, I saw Jaws 3 not in 3D, on a TV, I think was the first Jaws film I saw at a pretty young
age. Oh my
age,
gosh, that is terrible. Oh my goodness. Wow. You went straight for the worst one.
I mean, it was what was on cable or whatever. I don't even remember how I was. I vaguely remember being at someone else's house, which would have placed me at 8 or 9 years old.
That's the Louis Gossett one, the underwater park.
Yes.
Am I right?
Yes,
yeah,
Dennis
that's
Quaid.
Terrible. That's terrible. That's a bad one. Yeah, I'm sorry. That was your introduction.
I wasn't going to watch the sequels, but I did. And I was fascinated by the train wreck that was each one of them. And, you know, the behind the scenes.
That's too far. Come on. All right, we won't get into this, but that's too far.
There was this Jaws at 50, the definitive inside story, which we sort of semi-assigned to ourselves as well as rewatching the original film. And this got me looking at, there was some other very notable documentary, The Shark Is Still Working, I believe, that's on YouTube. Yeah. In full. That was a lot of the same stuff, but a slightly different emphasis. And yeah, I didn't realize that, like, this was the first film that was not only the first big summer blockbuster, but the first film that people actually got excited about, like the making of kind of stuff, that was part of the marketing from the very start. This Jaws log, the book that came out alongside the film. I did listen to an abridged version of the Peter Benchley thing that was just on YouTube that was only about 2 hours long. And yes, Richard Dreyfuss is supposed to die. I know that.
And have an affair with Brody's wife.
Yes.
Well, that's from the book.
Yes.
That's from the book.
Yeah.
That wasn't wise.
What a weird
thing. That wouldn't have worked.
I heard there was supposed to be a mafia subplot in the book, but that was not in the abridgment that I read, I guess. So the mafia wants the beach open. I don't understand exactly
don't
how that could
have
fit in there.
In the book.
Some would refer to that in a podcast. Maybe
a long time ago.
Maybe they were making that up. But
yeah, I read that 10 years ago, so I don't remember that mafia part, though.
They made a lot of good choices in the adaptation, clearly.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I don't know if we want to start off with, like, our relationship with Jaws,
just to
whatever.
Go through it, yeah.
Because, like, there's a lot to say about Steven Spielberg with this. But go ahead, Al.
I have, a similar relationship to Mark in that I only watched Jaws for the first time 5 or 6 years ago. Like,
oh my
gosh. Well after. And it's one of those things, like The Exorcist, which I only saw relatively recently, too. It's one of those movies that I found it very easy to put off because I knew so much about it just through osmosis in the popular culture that I was like, well, you know, it can't, maybe it's not even worth sitting through it. And that was very wrong. And as soon as I saw it, it's like, this is every bit as good as its reputation, very quickly became one of my favorite films. And really, it more than anything else gave me an enormous respect for Steven Spielberg as a filmmaker, because it's very easy to take. I grew up in the Jurassic Park generation, and it's almost easy to take him for granted as the author of all of the best 90s blockbuster movies. But as a kind of origin story for that genre of cinema, it's just a really fascinating artifact. And it's just a perfect movie. It is one of those perfect movies. Every single shot, there is something brilliant and thoughtful and perfect at work. And I hadn't seen any of the behind-the-scenes stuff or documentaries really before this. And the most interesting thing to me was just how hard it clearly was and how this movie seems like it was about to fall apart every stage of its production, and nonetheless has been, like, how Steven Spielberg clearly bit off more than he could chew with making this movie, and yet managed to not just pull it off, but create a defining piece of art. It's just a brilliant movie.
Was that a joke? Bit off more than he can chew?
Was
that
it? Was well, it should have been.
Was that intentional? It was pretty good, Al. I'm impressed. I was alive when this came out, but I was a toddler, and so I was clearly too young to watch this in the theater. So I have not seen this movie on the big screen. So I know it's coming back over Labor Day, and I think I might make a trip out to see it finally on the big screen. But I've seen it many, many times. I saw it, you know, it was one of the movies that almost everybody had in their VHS collection, along with a bunch of other Steven Spielberg movies. But it seemed like this and the paperback of Jaws, I saw everywhere growing up in the 70s and 80s, including on my parents' bookshelf. We had the Jaws paperback. And I remember seeing the Jaws paperback in the library. I don't know if you guys remember the paperback. They were these, the stands that the paperbacks would be on would spin around so you could look at them very conveniently. And Jaws is just everywhere. But I was not allowed to see it. My parents knew enough about me to know that this was too scary for me. And I had to sneak watch it at a friend's house. And I was probably too young when I saw it still. And that movie still to this day scares the crap out of me. That opening scene is so scary. The scene where the mother is the only one without a kid at the beach, you know, she's looking around for Alex, her son. That just breaks my heart every time. The jump scare of Hooper underwater and the dead guy's head coming out scares the crap out of me now. I'm a bona fide grown-up at this point, and I've seen this movie probably a dozen times. I love this movie to absolutely its core, and I think the making of it is almost as interesting as the movie itself, but it's not better than the movie itself. What they did with that movie is they didn't just salvage that story. They actually created something new and really wonderful, and they created a whole new genre for summer audiences. So I have great admiration for this movie. I love, love, love it.
I mean, of course I love the movie. I definitely saw it too young. I don't know, too young, because I wasn't scared by it. Well, I guess I was. All right, so backing up. So I think I saw it first on Laserdisc in the 1980s. I still own that Laserdisc, by the way. And, man, how old was I? I might have been like 5 or 6 when I first saw it.
Oof, that's young, Lawrence.
Oh, I saw Friday the 13th much younger than that.
Oy, oy, oy.
That's nothing for me. It genuinely scared me. I remember I was afraid to take a bath because it was in the water, if I remember correctly. No, I mean, I love the movie. I think it's very well made, great direction. Steven Spielberg was 29, 28 when he made the movie, which is still relatively
27,
young. 27.
He was 27? Because it came out in 1975. He was born in 1946, I want to say. And Steven Spielberg, what he does really well with this movie is not about the jump scares, it's about the suspense. And that's the reason why you don't see the shark for so long. One, because of course it wasn't working. But he was smart to say, we're not going to see it for a while because it builds a suspense. So when you do see the shark, it's a big, whoa, what's going on? So no, it's a great film. Love the film. Like, Sharks is by far my number one favorite, you know, shark movie of all time. But I love all the different iterations of it. I love Sharknado. I love Deep Blue Sea. I love all the different kind of weird variations on what shark is trying to do that are not taking themselves seriously or over the top. Like, I love the number of films this film inspired. Love it deeply. So no, I love Jaws, man. Love it a great deal. What about you, Mark? Do you enjoy the film?
I did. I think it's a wonderful piece of filmmaking. And I love all the monster kind of movies. Actually, I feel like Anaconda is my favorite sort of descendant of this as a cheesy piece
in
of
a way, yeah,
cinema.
I can see that.
I was just always more fascinated at the zoo by the big snakes. The sharks, you know, were a little less real to me or something like that.
The effects hold up better than Jaws, I think.
Yes, for certainly.
I mean, the computer stuff with Anaconda was just, it didn't age well at all.
I like comparing this to, you know, different monster flicks and different, just is it a horror movie? What exactly is going on here? Because so much of it is so similar to a Friday the 13th in that, you know, who's going to be the next victim? And so in some ways, and clearly, you know, what made Jaws great was the character work and the actors and the overall plot, which is just something that most of these other films do not have, that they just rely too much on the monster. And insofar as like Deep Blue Sea, it's good. It's because Samuel L. Jackson is hilarious in that movie. And the most memorable scene in that I will not spoil, but that involves
everybody's seen the scene. Everybody's seen that scene. I mean, but I think that what we need to remember is that this came out in 1975. Guys, check me. When did Halloween come out? When was Halloween dropped?
78
or 70 something.
Yeah, 70 something. This is before all that. So this is doing its own thing. It's not inspired by Halloween. It's not inspired by Friday the 13th. So I would say that those films are inspired by Jaws instead of Jaws being inspired by them. Mm-hmm. And so that's what's really kind of interesting about this film is that it sets the template for all these other films to kind of come after, right? This unkillable monster, whatever, you can kill it, but it's unkillable, right? This monster that's kind of creeping in the shadows, like this sets the template for that. And I think it's brilliant that Steven Spielberg had the foresight to do this and to make it a legitimate character study. Like the story that Quint tells is an incredible story. That could be a film all on its own, right? What's going on with Brody? What's going on with Hooper? Like, they're all very interesting three-dimensional characters, but you also have them placed within, and even what's going on with the mayor, right? You have all of them placed within the context of this horror story, right? I think it's definitely a horror movie, right? This horror movie that's set during 4th of July time. It's brilliant. Mm-hmm. It's a brilliant kind of concept.
But I think the movie, initially, they had characterized it as a monster movie. And it had to shift. They were forced to shift that perspective and make it more of a character study. I was listening to, or maybe I've watched all these documentaries on Jaws, and I think someone at some point said, and maybe it was Steven Spielberg himself, said that they had less time to film the shark. The shark was not working, as we all know. And they had all of this time to create these characters and really get them more beyond the two-dimensional characters that you find in more typical monster movies. And they were doing improvisation with each other. And they were actually able to kind of work with the script while they were filming it. And so that fabulous speech that Quint gives that you're just referencing, Lawrence, was part of, you know, it was, I think, much longer than originally it was in the script. And so he himself, Robert Shaw, who was a playwright, took it upon himself to rewrite it and narrow it down and get it down to about 5 pages. And that's why that he was able to work with it himself. And that's what made that speech so, so moving. I mean, it was, and he really got to, it really humanized that guy. You know, up until that point, he just seemed like a fisherman who just, you know, was kind of a funny figure. He seemed kind of like a bully. And after that, you really understood that this is a guy who was like Ahab. He was somebody who had it out for this creature, and it was part of who he was. He had this obsession, and we really understood that. And that's not something that you would normally get in what was quote unquote supposed to be a monster movie.
I was going to bring up Moby Dick too, because I think it is entirely incorrect to call Jaws a monster movie. And it did doubtlessly inspire a whole bunch of monster movies. But a lot of that is people taking, I think, the wrong lesson from Jaws as a film. It's not a creature feature any more than Moby Dick's a creature feature. I had it in my head that it's best treated as a thriller, although I think Lawrence has convinced me very quickly that it is actually a horror movie, because the core emotional story of the movie is about how Brody and then later the other two men as well relate to this terrible, unknowable force. So it's like classic horror movie story. And what elevates it, I mean, what's amazing about Jaws is that Jaws himself is in a lot of respects the least interesting part of the film, because all of the emotional meat of the film, pardon the expression, comes from Brody, Quint, and other guy. Who's the other guy? He's
Hooper.
Actually my favorite.
Hooper.
Hooper. But Jaws being the least emotionally significant part of the film in a lot of respects is nonetheless absolutely perfectly executed, and everything about it is amazing. So this is a movie where like everything is firing on all cylinders.
I want to be a little negative.
Yeah.
Having just seen the original movie for the first time in a long time, I felt like the second half, I know people are like, oh, every moment of those three in the boat is beautiful, and they improvised a lot of it, and they, you know, that I thought it kind of dragged. I thought that it was a bit much. It seemed a little self-indulgent to me.
That was a heck of a zag there, Mark. Heck of a zag. It's
tension, Mark. He's building tension.
I know Spielberg himself says he just loves that whole section and can watch it again and again and again and thinks it's the best thing he's ever done. So I'm fine, you know, admitting that there are differences of opinion on this, and maybe, but I've just, nothing that I watched in any of this said anything negative about the movie at all. And I just think that that is the other thing. So obviously the score, the shark part, great. When there's just like, even in that, in the course of them chasing the shark, the music gets too happy and excited and like, oh, and now we're about enjoying the water. Woo, woo, woo. Like, I just thought this was tonally very weird. And maybe it was just a 70s thing.
Wow. Wow. John Williams coming for him too. Oh, man.
So those are the two main issues that I had.
Those are hot takes, Mark.
Those are scorching lava takes, boy.
Also, interesting thing, like, it was quite a while before I realized, you know, in watching the making of like, whose head that was that they found. Like, which actual character, because when they then in the making of highlight, like, look at this colorful character from the island who, like, made up all his own lines. Oh, that's the guy whose head it is. But I didn't put that together. Again, maybe I didn't see the movie enough times. And then when I mentioned this to my daughter, who had just saw it for the first time with me, she was like, oh, I just thought that was, you know, the Robert Shaw character who was saying all that wacky stuff. So in other words, there's a few characters who look a little similar to each other. I don't know. There were things that were that could have been more clearly choreographed. I don't know if that's really a flaw, or it seems like a film should not demand that you have to see it five times to get everything, given what it was trying to do.
Wow, man. I mean,
I think those are probably all perfectly good notes, but really, I think just kind of highlights how, like, that. I can't think of any equivalent niggles with it, and that's a pretty impressive feat.
Congratulations, Mark. That's
I disagree about the barrels. I love.
I disagree about everything that Mark just said. But I mean, it's 1975. The type of films that they're making in 1975 are slow, laborious movies. Yes. Like, look at The Conversation. Look at the movies that are coming out around that time. It's more of a bug of the time than a problem with the movie.
In a world where The Godfather was the previous highest grossing movie, yeah.
I think that's more of a feature of 1970 filmmaking, because that's the era of, you know, all the Easy Riders, all those, like, I think, what was it called? The New American or something like that. So, you know, I hear what you're saying on that, but, like, I still think this is a propulsive movie, and when it slows down for purpose, right? So when it slows down and Quint gives that speech, there's a purpose there, and then when it slows down...
That I had no problem with. It was more they're drinking together and the... Just, well, anyway.
You have to establish the relationship between the characters, and then it's slowly building dread, as Al said, right? So that when you get to the end, it's impactful. But if you jump too quickly to that end, it won't be as impactful. But I hear what you're saying. I just deeply disagree with it.
It's pacing. I disagree with you, Mark. I think that this movie actually really moves. But I think what they do such a good job of is he knows when to speed up and when to slow down, when to really, you know, press on the gas when we need those, the, you know, to release the pressure a little bit and laugh a little bit. I mean, because this movie has elements of horror. I think of it as more of a thriller, but it's also about family. It is horror, but it has all of these other elements. And also you're seeing that the family relationship. You know, you're seeing all of these different elements of each character, which really makes it a Steven Spielberg movie. There are so many parts of it that for me, I think, oh my gosh, you know, that one of my favorite scenes is that scene where Brody is sitting at his kitchen table and his youngest son is sitting there and they're making faces at each other and the son is mimicking what Brody's doing. And you can see that Brody's just had the worst day, just the worst day, and he is exhausted and he has this relationship with his son. And it's just, quite frankly, it's so touching. And you wouldn't necessarily see that in a horror movie. You wouldn't get scenes like that in a typical horror movie. And I just think it's absolutely that Steven Spielberg magic for sure. But I think it was partly developed by how difficult this movie was to make. And so he was able to bring out those sorts of moments because he needed it, because the creature wasn't, you know, again, wasn't going to be there for it.
Had you heard the Roy Scheider story about that scene, which is that Spielberg did not come up with that. It was not in the script. It was just something like that the kid was doing with him. And then Scheider was like, look at this. And then they filmed it. So like that is setting this, you know, exactly like the dynamics on the boat, that Spielberg set up this thing that they could feel comfortable doing stuff and trying stuff and letting a lot of the extras and the, you know, ad-lib their lines or just.
You're going to need a bigger boat was ad-libbed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's such smart filmmaking. That is such, anyway, of course he's a brilliant filmmaker, but I think it's to trust your actors, to really trust the process. That takes a lot of balls. So
like for a 27-year-old guy, it's just an insanely mature approach to filmmaking. And yeah, I don't know. Is there anybody else like him?
You could point to somebody was saying, oh, Ryan Coogler is like the new Spielberg. You know, there are lots of younger people that you can sort of point at as having
George
that
Lucas,
promise.
James Cameron.
But until they have that track record over that many years, you can't say anybody's a Spielberg or something, you know.
But he has that voice that, I mean, who, you don't want to be the next Spielberg. You want to be your own person.
Sure,
you
want to be
know?
Your own person, definitely.
He has his own voice, and it was so clear from the get-go. This was, what, his second feature film? And his third overall, I think he had a TV movie. I mean, that voice was so singular right away at 27 years old. That's really, really special.
Hearing him talk about the way he approached his previous film, what was that called? The one about the murderous truck?
Duel is the TV film.
Yeah. There's a bit in the documentary where he's talking about how he insisted that that was shot on location because the studio wanted to shoot the whole thing on lots with rolling scenery going past the windows. And he was like, no, that's going to look terrible. I'd rather not make this movie than make it on a lot. And what kind of like 26-year-old with the opportunity to make their first studio film has that kind of artistic integrity? I know I posed a question, but there can't really be anyone like Spielberg because he was the one who had to make all those innovations and just change the face of the industry. That it seems like he's the one who gave directors of broad audience movies permission to be artistic and creative to the degree that they can be.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was just that it worked.
Yeah.
That sometimes you hear about, like, I don't remember offhand exactly what the conditions of making the movie Waterworld, but if you heard like, oh yes, this was the first, it was so expensive and they made it entirely on the water and you're just like, folly, folly, folly. I recall watching the making of stuff for Star Wars Episode II and like just exactly how huge it was, the biggest, and like, oh my gosh.
I mean, I know that we're lauding Steven Spielberg, but I mean, Spike Lee would like to have a word. Martin Scorsese would like to have a word. Like, there are other filmmakers who were young, who were making really, really good films, you know, so Steven Spielberg wasn't the only guy. But I will say, this is his first great movie. Like, you saw hints of greatness in Duel, a movie that I still own. And that's a monster movie as well, in a way. And so you see hints of Jaws and Duel, right? This thing stalking, you really don't know what's going on. You never really see the driver, if I remember correctly, right? So you see the relationship. So Spielberg was always kind of interested in those kinds of films. Like, you know, he's always interested in horror films, but he's interested in elevating. So the same thing about a family relationship, you find that in Duel. The same thing about like this kind of whimsical kind of score at times, you find that in Duel. So Steven Spielberg is really good. And you see it also in Poltergeist, which is a film that he says he didn't direct, but he certainly had a hand in it, right? This whimsical score, this horror, like he's always been interested in that. And he's returned back to that. I mean, Jurassic Park, the first one, I would argue is a horror movie in a way. Elevated, to be sure, horror movie in a way. You know, War of the Worlds, horror movie, right? He kind of returns back to this over and over and over again, while he's also doing things like E.T., Raiders of the Lost Ark, whatever. So, you know, I think that Spielberg is a great film director. He's really, really good. And this is really his legitimately first great film. I wonder if it would be as celebrated if it was not as financially successful as it was. That's what I would argue is what would make it a really, really great film. Like a great film is one that you go back to and say, regardless of how much money this movie made, this movie is really, really good. Now, I think this does stand up to that, right? But nevertheless, regardless of how much money this movie made, right, it was really, really good. And the easiest counterpoint would be Jaws 2, which I think is a good movie. I think Jaws 2 is perfectly fine. I don't think it's great. I don't think it's on this level. The first hour of that movie really, really drags. You're talking about the second hour of this movie dragging, Mark. Watch the first hour of Jaws 2.
No, I did. It's the teen thing. So just I watched a making of Jaws 2 thing. And it, mm-hmm. you know, it made me much sympathetic that, like, it had to be made. Like, there was just no way that it was not going
to be. Oh,
there was no way.
Yeah,
they were like, if we don't make it, somebody else is going to make it. And, you know, it'll be a knockoff. And so let's just make it ourselves. And the fact that they got enough of the people, but if it was like, you know, the guy who wrote the script, Carl Gottlieb, I believe his name, was the punch up comic relief author for the first script. Mm-hmm. And so he came up with this idea of like, kids like to cruise on cars. What if they like to cruise on sailboats?
In boats, yeah.
In boats. And so, yeah, and definitely. I think she really likes you. She's checking you out. And like, no, this kind of teen antics is never going to be good in any movie.
However, I would say the second half of that movie is great, though. The second half of that movie really good. It's just that the teen stuff is just so cringy and it's terrible. And like, I don't even know if you guys know this, but there's a movie called Angel about a teen who was a prostitute at night. Anyway, she's in that movie. But nevertheless, the first half of that movie is not very good at all. But the second half is when they kind of really get into the horror stuff, and it works much better. But that is what this movie could have been. It could have been that, like, uneven, not great. But because Steven Spielberg has such an eye and so committed to his craft and is really committed. And I think Al is saying something. For a guy this young to be like, no, we're going to do it this way, right? And to stick to his guns and say, yo, either we're going to do it this way or I'm not going to be involved with this film. And for it to turn out the way that it did, like, it really speaks to Steven Spielberg's genius. He is so incredibly good at what he does that when he makes those calls, now, it doesn't always work. There's that movie Always that I think is not very good, right? You know, it doesn't always work. But when it does, it really, really works.
Alan, Sarah, did you watch any of the sequels?
No.
I didn't watch any of the sequels, I'm afraid.
I mean, it's probably better. I thought, Al, you would be just like, I don't believe that the sequels happened. They're not in my head canon.
They're completely unnecessary. Like,
I didn't mind them.
I'm sure they're fine, but I don't feel like I'm.
Jaws 2 is fine.
It's not going to make my enjoyment of Jaws any better to see the sequels, right?
Let me just. So Jaws 3, I actually just finished this morning, and I do have that.
That's really bad.
Watching a 3D movie in 2D and having this be my introduction to the whole thing, and how silly it is. Like, ooh, there's a chopped off arm that's floating right at the front of the screen, and all these things that are jumping out in them, squirting syringes at the camera. That is so funny. And the fact that it's Dennis Quaid and Leah Thompson, but overall, like, it was boring. The whole first half of it was boring.
I agree.
I was just going to give up on it. It finally got at least kind of fun, but it's a profoundly stupid movie. And yeah, it doesn't make any sense. Jaws 4, you know, Jaws
the Revenge.
4, right. Jaws the Revenge ignores Revenge, Jaws 3 completely. They each have different versions of the children from the couple in Jaws 1 and 2 that are grown up, different actors who have taken different trajectories. So it's really, and Jaws 4 is just so remarkably misguided. It's just so such a bad premise, and everybody in the thing is commenting, but it's getting at the idea of what is the fear from Jaws in the first place. Is it, you know, this thing that will just haunt your nightmares? And this is, you know, such that it, I just watched a new film. I didn't quite get to the end of it because it was rather long, called The Black Devil. It just came out a couple of years ago. A giant megalodon.
I definitely watched that.
You know, it's a meg, so it's bigger than a. But it had the same like it will mess with your mind. You'll hallucinate things. You'll hallucinate body parts in the water. So I think this is hilarious when sharks become magic. that in this case of the revenge, like it's tracking the family members. It somehow tastes, so it actually eats less people. Like, there's maybe a few people that kind of get in the way, but mostly, like, he's going straight for only the family members. So it is totally ridiculous, and it's just one of those things that, like, the remaining Roy Scheider's wife's character, played by the original actress, is there, and only she believes that it's, you know, it desecrates the whole thing. To have, you know, your children, you save... and you defeat the shark, and, like, oh, they're just going to get grown up and eaten by sharks... attacked by shark, like, so it's so terribly wrong anyway, but I would highly recommend it. I thought it was hilarious.
No, it's fun. It's very fun.
It sounds like it misses, though, the whole point. Like, one thing that the original Jaws did was that it created this mass fear of going into the ocean, you know, because sharks actually exist. They actually exist. And in the ocean, you can't see the bottom. You don't know what you're swimming in. And it sounds like if you're creating this magical shark, they're no longer sharing the same premise.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like the reason to watch Jaws: The Revenge is to see a movie where they made all of the worst possible choices in making it Jaws.
But it's so fun, though. I mean, so Jaws 1 is Jaws. Jaws 2... I think it's good. You know, it's good. First half, whatever. Second half, I think it's really, really good. Jaws 3 is an abomination. Don't even watch that. But Jaws the Revenge, look, it's not a good movie, okay? It's not a good movie. But it is so deeply fascinating that I would recommend it for watching, because it's fun. It's not going to scare you. You kind of have to do away with the premise of the original film. Like, don't bring that into this film. This is a bad knockoff. But it's fun. It's a fun film. And honestly, and this gets us into a larger discussion about other films inspired by Jaws, that is by far what you go... Now, is it Open Water? I think Open Water is a shark movie that is not fun. Like, that is a grueling survival movie that is deeply depressing, very sad. I watched it and I enjoyed it, but it's not a fun watch.
That's kind of like 127 hours, that kind of film?
But it's in water. And it's based on a true story of people who were stuck in water and sharks came after them. There's no great white, but sharks came after them. That's not a fun film. But Sharknado, Jaws of Revenge,
The Meg 2,
all these other films... Deep Blue Sea, by far. And if you haven't seen Deep Blue Sea, skip forward 10 seconds. But when that shark jumps out of the water and gets Samuel L. Jackson, I saw that in the movie theater. I thought to myself, that's pure cinema. That's greatness, right? That's what I come to the movies for. Because it's fun. It is fun. It is silly. Samuel L. Jackson knows what movie he's in. He gives this rousing speech, and then he gets snapped up. That's what you want. And so I think that outside of things like Open Water or something like that, that's what these movies kind of go for now. They go for fun. They don't go for deep movies. They don't go for something that has incredible depth and children, all kind of stuff. They go for fun. And I think that that's the only way you can go now, because that's all that's left when it comes to these shark movies.
You know, I wanted to see if you guys knew the filmmakers... According to the documentaries that I've been watching, like Jaws at 50 and The Shark is Still Working, filmmakers, very successful filmmakers, rewatch Jaws sometimes like every year. You know, they regularly watch this movie as inspiration. And I wondered why. What is it about Jaws that is so inspirational to other filmmakers, do you think?
One of the things that I thought was most interesting that Steven Spielberg said in his interview in Jaws at 50 was when he was making Jaws, he approached filmmaking on a shot-for-shot basis. And his approach to filming to choosing every element of Jaws was essentially like, what is the correct information to give the audience at this stage of the story? And how can I use every element of the frame to communicate that information? It's not a particularly like highfalutin way of filmmaking, but it kind of goes to the heart of what craft in direction looks like. That's my impression of why Jaws feels so special. It is a real masterclass in direction as craft. If what you think the job of the director is to communicate all the right information at all the right time using all the available resources of a camera lens, then every shot in Jaws is working its ass off.
Mm-hmm.
And every time you watch it, if you just pay attention to a frame that you haven't particularly paid attention to before, you'll see something that you missed. It's an endlessly fascinating film.
I guess what about, talking about this just as the legacy of the summer blockbuster at all.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not sure what to say about that as interesting piece of cinema business history that they thought that kids don't want to go to the theater in the summer because it's too hot. They want to be out playing. And then somehow the conventional wisdom changed around this movie of no, actually this is the perfect time that people want to see. I've seen more movies in the last couple months than I have the rest of the year.
Yeah. I find all that stuff really interesting because it was originally going to be a winter release, but because the shooting schedule was tripled, essentially, they had to push it to the summer, which was sort of the dumping ground for movies. And I think what they did is they put the movie into more screens. So it was over 400 screens, which was a huge release at the time. And they poured all this money into marketing and advertising. And it obviously worked, you know, up until then. This was the most successful movie. It ran forever. I remember when movies would run in theaters for months and months and months. And I think by the end of 2 days after its release, I think it made all its money back. And by Labor Day, I think it had made more money than any other movie in history up until then.
The trailers are terrific as well. Like, see it before you go swimming.
Yes.
And once you've got a movie that's good enough that like you suitably impressed the first people who came in because of the trailers, then you're off to the races. But every bit of the film, including the marketing, is world-class.
Oh, yeah. And the merch. I mean, everybody I knew had a Jaws t-shirt. You couldn't go that summer without a Jaws t-shirt, you know? I mean, that does a lot of your advertising for you. They would show these pictures of the lines to the movie theater of just people in line all around the block to see this movie and how it would sell out and then people would stand around for another couple of hours to see the next showing. That in and of itself is a great way to sell a movie.
And just thinking about like the merch stuff, you just know that George Lucas was obviously hanging around a lot. You know, he was there taking meticulous notes.
Definitely.
On merchandising
strategies. You know it.
It cannot be overstated how this changed the movie industry. It just did. Like, this is not a fascinating tale. This changed movies. It did. Because before this movie, they had no idea that they could do this, that it could be this big. And for better or for worse, and I would argue in a lot of ways for worse, because superheroes come because of this. Action films come because of this, right? Summer being the time, the reason why we are seeing so many movies drop during the summertime and why February for a large part and January to an extent is kind of dead is because of this film. This film changed the release schedule. It changed the way that you market films. It changed the way that you even made films because now they're chasing what this film did, right? It changed films. It fundamentally did. You can see a difference between the films that came before 1975 and around 1976 and on, right? You can see that difference. And this is the film that did it. I'm very mixed on it because I wish that every film now was not IP, was not all about big tentpole films. Because this was an original film, but it set the template for films to not be original because they're now chasing the big bucks as they were. And so I wish that we could get back to more original films. You know, I wish we could get back to do things like Sinners or whatever. But for better or for worse, this changed things. It really, really did. And I think that it is a testament, number one, to horror, that a horror movie did this, even though you guys are trying to call it a thriller or an action movie. It is a freaking horror movie. It is a monster movie. That is the driving force in this film. But two, a horror movie can be elevated. It doesn't have to be base. It doesn't have to be doing the lowest common denominator. It can have funny moments. It can have levity. It can have joy, because that makes the horror hit even more, right? The reason why you're so invested in Brody making it is because you've seen his home life. It's because you've seen what he's dealing with. The fact that he's scared of the water, all this other kind of stuff, it really kind of drives it home. But yeah, this movie changed films. It just did.
I was looking up while we're talking here of what the current, like, are there action figures? And of course there are of the three principals. There's also one that's Jaws, Chrissy's arm on the beach action figure. And the
oh
arm,
my
the arm
God.
Is just as
that.
Long.
I want that. I actually want that.
It's
really?
It's $50 from Etsy. So maybe it's a, you know, some.
That sounds like a knockoff. Yeah. That's unfortunate.
But it's a very realistic looking packaging.
I would love that.
How big is it?
It's as big as a person. So if you got all four action figures, you have a giant arm with some muck around it.
No, thanks. I'll pass.
I would take it in a minute. Love it. Let's go. And then I give it to Sarah and make her put it in her house.
No, please don't do that.
I do not understand how, like, I feel like Star Wars was a thing for kids that they could really get swept up in this and you know, take over their imaginations and want to live in this world. I don't see Jaws as having that potential. I do not see that. I do not want to live in Amity. I do not want to join the shark hunters.
No. Absolutely not.
No. Yeah. So it just seems like a very different kind of appeal. Yes, it works as a movie experience, but not as a world. As much as there are these conventions and things, and I understand the appeal of the community and whatever, and go, you know, go on location and see where all the things were filmed. That might be fun.
You're not hungry for the Jaws expanded universe.
No. I mean, well, no. Came up in one of the documentaries that one of the writers, right, the guy that came up with the long version of the speech about 50 years ago, you know, Quint's backstory, proposed that he wanted to write the script that as Jaws 2. I think that's the only way to make an actually good sequel is to tell that story or something like that.
It would have been dark.
Oh, yeah.
It would have been dark.
It would have been quite different.
Yeah, Quint's story.
But it did not fulfill the business reasons for doing a sequel. I mean, I think it probably would have still sold great, and it could have been a great movie, and they could have made it really exciting. I feel like there are things that can be like long form, very exciting, but very historically accurate, you know, that can work in the popcorn and the art movie level, just like this did.
Like, you just need Steven Spielberg. Problem.
There you go. That's the problem. Hey, has any of you gone on the Universal Studios studio tour?
I sure have. Absolutely.
So I grew up in California, and most of my family is in Southern California. So Universal Studios was one of our regular things to do other than Disneyland. And so we would go on that studio tour, and every year it would change a little bit, but they kept that Jaws section where the tram would go by. We were in Amity, and you would see the little boat there, the orca, and the poor fisherman in the rowboat would get clobbered by the shark, and the shark would come by on the right side of the tram and basically squirt you with water the whole way. And it was really fun and thrilling, especially for, you know, a 10-year-old. And I think it's still part of the tram ride. I think it's still
it
a
is.
Thing. The,
yep,
the yep, last time we were there was we took my daughter when she was, I think, around 12 or something like that. And it was still part of it then. I hear that the orca boat is no longer. I think it decomposed, unfortunately.
My favorite bit of Steven Spielberg interview that I saw in the lead up to this is him talking about the orca on the lot. And I don't know where it originally comes from, but it's just this really touching, like, little psychological insight into Steven Spielberg and his trauma and his pain. because he's talking about, oh, they used to have the orca there and, you know, it was really nice and I used to like coming to look at it because when I was making Jaws, the orca was where I would go to have my nervous breakdowns just try and steady myself when everything was collapsing around me and I really like going to see it. And then he was like, I think I'm going to go and talk to the executives because they should put the orca back there because I think people would really like seeing the orca there. And it's just this beautiful moment where he's like, saying, yes, Steve, you tell yourself whatever you need to, but please do make sure that they put the orca back because it feels like you really need an emotional support prop in the Universal lot.
I need a Steven Spielberg sighting. I have been to Universal Studios so many times and I cannot believe I did not see Steven Spielberg while I was there. I mean, it's a working studio. I mean, I thought for all of the amount of times I've been on that studio tour and hearing that he would hide in the orca, and listen to people scream at the fake shark as it went by and squirted them with water. I know.
They'll stuff him, mount him after he's gone in the Universal lot, like Jeremy Bentham in University College.
Gross. Wow, Jeremy Bentham, that's a deep cut. Utilitarianism. Okay, so wait a minute. So, Sarah, you went on that ride, but you hadn't seen Jaws?
That was how I got introduced to it, too, correct. Now that you're reminding me. Yes, that I correct. That I went at age 6 or something.
Yeah. Mm.
Interesting. Yep.
I'm very jealous of the fact that you got to do that as a local attraction as a kid.
It was very, very fun. Very fun.
Oh, Dunkirk was the movie I was trying to think of before.
Oh, Christopher Nolan.
Dunkirk. Yeah.
I actually quite enjoyed that movie. It took me a while to figure out what the heck was going on with that movie with all the time stuff.
So somebody could still make that as a shark movie, I'm saying. Like, it could be an official Jaws prequel. Somebody should do that. Whether they have the rights to Jaws or not, they could still tell that public historical story and make it more. They don't have to have Quint as a character in it. It just there's a lot of people there.
And who read the book? Anybody? Lawrence, you read the book?
Of course I did.
Me too. I read it.
I haven't.
I just got the feel of it from that 2-hour, I assume abridged version, unless it was a really short book.
If it was 2 hours, yeah, it was definitely abridged. It was definitely abridged.
I want to know that mafia plot line.
Well, it's a really good book. It's a quick read. I think Peter Benchley, am I right about that, Sarah?
Yeah.
Yes.
He's actually a pretty good writer. Like, he's written some interesting books.
He was a journalist. That was his debut novel, but he was a journalist before that.
The movie is by far better than the book. It definitely is elevating the material. But as far as the core bare bones of the plot, pretty good book. I don't understand what's going on with Brody's wife. I don't understand what's going on with a lot of that stuff. But as far as the tension, the craftsmanship of the book is pretty good. Pretty good book. I would definitely recommend people read it.
She was a city gal and she married an aw shucks sheriff, a local sheriff, but she longed for the city. And so when Hooper came into town with all his worldliness, they make Hooper out to be a scumbag that in fact, Hooper is like initially by phone, you know, oh, we've had a shark attack. And they call this guy and he says, oh, well, that was probably just a one-time thing. They don't stay in the same place. So, like, he's responsible for them continuing to not do anything, not, you know, very, very different. And then he gets in the cage and he wants to take pictures of it. And so, of course, it just breaks open the cage and eats him. So that's...
Movie's better.
As an asshole character that you are happy is dead. Seeing Jaws 3 reminded me of there's the equivalent asshole character in that. He actually goes, his whole body is in the shark, not being chomped by the teeth, but in the shark. And he's flailing around. And the way that I don't mind spoiling this, but the way that they kill the shark is then just like in Jaws 1, where, you know, there's a thing that the shark has eaten that he's like, oh, I'll shoot the thing, you know, that'll help. But the bad guys had grenades. And so, of course, he's holding a grenade. So the Dennis Quaid and the woman have to figure out how to use a stick to pull the pin out of the grenade that is in the shark's, that they can see clearly whenever the shark opens his mouth, their little frenemy there.
Yeah.
That is a very bad movie. It is a very bad movie.
I thought that was worth the price of admission. So much of the rest of it was boring. Lou Gossett Jr. as like the sort of equivalent of the mayor of I run SeaWorld and I'm going to keep it open, and is just a ridiculous character. Doing this right after winning an Oscar for Officer and Gentleman is just such a strange, strange choice.
I want to say he was making this movie while he was winning. Like, so it wasn't like he made the choice.
Right. Yeah.
But it's bad. It's just a bad film. It's bad writing. It's a bad film. The 3D effects of it have aged poorly. I maintain there's nothing to recommend that film. Jaws 2, Jaws 4, I definitely recommend those. Particularly Jaws 2. Jaws 2, I was really kind of taken by how good that was. It's silly, but it's good. I enjoyed it.
You know, I want to know what happened to the mayor after they killed the shark. Like, is he voted out? Is he run out of town? Is he run off that island?
In the book, he, like, during, while they're having their long on the boat scene, he, like, goes and sees the wife and is like, there's nothing for me here. I'm leaving town, you know, because he's so disgraced. But in Jaws 2, he's gotten reelected and he's still
he's there in Jaws
the same
too.
Old stuff.
Wow.
That was a touching thing in the documentary, the older documentary about how his wife was having cancer. So, like, he wanted to just walk off the set, and they filmed all his stuff really quick so he could go
leave. Like, in 5 days.
Yeah. And then he died almost immediately after that himself. His wife was fine.
Oh, wow.
I think just that whole character arc of, like it's such a familiar thing in movies to us now that now it just seems really annoying. Like, come on. You're going to keep the beaches open. What's wrong with you? But at the time, that was a an innovative trope, I think.
That's what led to Fidel Castro's glowing review of the book.
It's an indictment of capitalism. That's so great.
I mean, but it is. It is an indictment of capitalism, though.
If you look up the Onion's review of the book or the movie, it's like that it's Roy Scheider's latent homosexuality, that as he's witnessing these other two men in the boat getting along, his latent homosexuality literally leaps out of the water and like it's
I mean, it's sure, you could put together a really great coherent like queer reading of this film. My preferred take is to think it's the greatest film about masculinity to me that exists. It's right up there with Rocky. It's all about masculine modernity, different ways of being a man.
It's true.
You could choose the shark way.
Choose a shark way. I mean, the shark is the patriarchy.
The only woman who is single gets eaten by a shark right away. Like, the only woman with some sense of adventure gets punished right off the bat.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other way of being a man is the guy who's just passed out on the beach.
Jaws 2, they have a, like, characters are about to have sex. Shark better come and eat them right now, because they're trying to do it on a boat.
Well, that's just dumb. Like, it's dumb to try to have sex on a sailboat. Like, so they deserve to be eaten. They're dumb. How do you do that? It's impossible. You can't have sex with a sailboat.
Well, in Jaws 3, he's like, oh, if you hadn't interrupted me.
Figured it out, Lawrence.
No, it is dumb. It is dumb to try. It is really dumb.
Depends on the footage.
The water's, I guess the motion of the water is helping you, but like, come on, man. Like, particularly that sailboat. Like, if you look at that particular sailboat, no, not that one. It's incredibly uncomfortable.
People will find a way.
Well, in Jaws 3, one of the character says to his brother, like, oh, I would have gotten some for the first time in the water if you hadn't interrupted me. And like, I got it. That's physiologically not possible. I wrote our little intro right before we got on here, but I was thinking, yes, it's as if God created the devil and called it Pretty Much Pop, a culture podcast. That was one of them. And Pretty Much Pop, the first podcast recorded entirely on the ocean. I thought that was...
That's not a good one. But the first one, you should have done that one.
That one was a good one.
Yeah, drop that in.
All right. Well, folks, maybe we'll do some after talk and stick around. Patreon.com/PrettyMuchPop. Everybody else, thanks for listening. Happy sharking.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
What is sharking? Bye. Don't do that, but bye, guys.
Pretty Much Pop is part of the Partially Examined Life podcast network. Get more Pretty Much Pop at prettymuchpop.com. Get bonus content for every episode at patreon.com/prettymuchpop.